In other recent events, this past week marked the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Japan on August 6th and 9th. Around the nation and the world, marches and vigils were organized in remembrance of the nuclear destruction of Hiroshima. You might have taken part yourself in the commemoration ceremony in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on Tuesday evening, Nagasaki Day. In Lower Manhattan, a dozen groups, including the War Resisters League, Jonah House, and the Catholic Worker, led a procession of over 200, marching in a single file, carrying lanterns and signs or banners, depicting scenes of nuclear war. WBAI was there and filed this report.
They started from Tompkins Square Park, marching slowly through the thriving nightlife of St. Mark's Place. Many were dressed in white, the color of mourning in East Asian countries. Tom Good from the War Resisters League explains the significance of the march.
We're attempting to commemorate what happened in Hiroshima, the crimes that occurred there at the hand of the U.S. government, and also to make linkages to what's happening now in Iraq, the crimes that are occurring there. We're also dressed in white because these are our Asian brothers and sisters who were murdered at the hand of our government, and we're trying to pay our respects in a dignified, solemn procession. This occurring in the heart of the village, which is a little bit noisy.
I see a lot of people screaming there. What is the meaning of this?
I've heard some comments about remember Pearl Harbor. It's the 9/11 syndrome, the knee-jerk reaction, the attitude on the part of some Americans that Asian lives don't matter. If the bomb saved American lives, that was the goal. They missed the point entirely. We all bleed the same. And we're bleeding right now in Iraq, so we're trying to draw those linkages. But I would like to point out that a number of people who are not yelling have been very responsive. They're in our corner.
As the procession stretched past them, many onlookers froze in their footsteps, surprised at the solemnity of the marchers, and for a few moments perhaps reflecting on the enormity of a day in history when the first weapon of mass destruction forever changed the face of war. This young woman shared her thoughts.
Do you think there is any connection between Iraq and Hiroshima?
I don't think they're connected. I mean, yet to be determined who's right, who's wrong, how it's going to end up.
How do you determine who is right and who is wrong?
It's not that black and white.
There's been bombing of civilian populations in both cases?
Yes, there has been.
Do you think it's right?
I'm in the military, so...
It doesn't matter, you still have an opinion.
I think that any death is wrong. I personally wouldn't want to have to kill someone, you know, but desperate times call for desperate measures, and sometimes something like that has to happen, you know? But the dropping of the atomic bomb, I really didn't believe in.
We're in Iraq for the right reason?
I couldn't really tell you exactly why we went in there, other than what we think, which is that we went in to help them be cleared of a dictator.
What rank are you?
I can't say that.
So if they told you to go, you would go?
Yes.
Without any second thought whether it's right or wrong?
Yes.
The march ended around the fountain at the foot of Christopher Street. Marchers took turns speaking the words of victims' families.
When we came to the river, there was a man who was really suffering. He was black all over, and he kept saying at the river, "Give me water, give me water." I felt so sorry for him.
Matt D'Aloisio from the Catholic Worker gave a perspective for this type of anti-war demonstration.
People having a good time in the village and they're seeing you, and it seems like counterpoint to what they're doing.
You know, we're not really out to embarrass people. I think all of us, ourselves included, are victims of this society, and we lose our collective memory, we lose history. So I think what we did tonight was a reminder of what has happened in the past and an effort to prevent it from happening again in the future. We, in different ways, mark August 6th and 9th every year. On the 9th, we'll be downtown near Foley Square and then processing to the Federal Building, where the Army Corps of Engineers, among other offices, are. Of course, the Manhattan Project is named after the Army Corps of Engineers in New York.
From the banks of the Hudson at Christopher Street, this is Fred Gwynn for the WBI Sunday News.
For photos from the Portsmouth, New Hampshire commemoration event, you can look online at www.seacoastpeacerespons.org, where freelance photographer Pat Morris has posted his photos. Also from New Hampshire, Ann Miller, the director of New Hampshire Peace Action, wrote this piece for the occasion. It is titled, From Hiroshima to Humanity. As the 60th anniversaries of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki make their way into history, we have seen the American press cover pundits who continue to justify the use of atomic weapons by the U.S. on civilians in August of 1945. We are told once again, as we were in our high school history courses, that dropping the bombs brought an abrupt conclusion to World War II and saved countless American lives. Reasonable counterarguments exist, that Japan, after having had its cities firebombed to cinders, was on the brink of collapse in August 1945. Or, after $2 billion in funding, the use of the bomb was required to justify its existence and expense. Or, that the U.S. was determined to show the former Soviet Union and the world the extent of its new power in a post-war world. However, this kind of debate obscures a greater concern on these particular anniversaries, which is the irrational nationalism and might makes right mentality that currently governs our country's thinking, a kind of thinking which so easily leads to the justification of death and suffering of the innocent. What is the risk in stepping beyond our borders and considering a larger view? The truth obscured by the jingoism of a corporate-driven government and media is that our shared humanity is more fundamental than the patriotic us-versus-them thinking created by those in power in nation-states. I have met survivors from Hiroshima and listened to their stories. I am humbled by their grace and forgiveness, and energized by their determination to eradicate all nuclear weapons. My brothers and sisters are the people who live in my neighborhood and around the world, be they in Tehran, Hiroshima, New York, or Concord, not the power elite in Washington subsidizing U.S. defense contractors and the nuclear labs at Los Alamos and Livermore. The anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki provide us with an opportunity to examine our shared humanity and to think about the kind of world we want to live in and leave to our children. We face the possibility of annihilation without representation on any given day. In 15 minutes, one man, President George Bush, can initiate a nuclear holocaust with the 10,000 nuclear weapons at his disposal. What could be less democratic than putting the fate of the world in one person's hands? We know that the Bush administration is enamored of nuclear weapons and that they are a stated cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy. In the last few years, U.S. nuclear policy has shifted to include the option of preemptive nuclear strikes on other nations, even non-nuclear states. Senators Sununu and Gregg recently voted for funding that could result in a new nuclear bunker-buster weapon that could be used on targets in Iran or North Korea. Will we have pundits and politicians in the future saying that a tactical nuclear strike on Iran's suspected nuclear facilities was justified? Will we in the U.S. breathe a sickened sigh of relief that our children are not the ones dying from burns, starvation, and radiation sickness? Will we keep our fingers crossed that the fallout doesn't spin its way around the globe to our communities? What is our responsibility as citizens of the world and citizens of the most militarily dominant power in the world to make the world safe for all human beings? These questions seem to me to be the real questions worth pondering on August 6th and August 9th.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Down by the riverside.
Saturday.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Study War No More. Now for Nancy Lancey with Peace in the World. This is Making Waves on WSCA, Portsmouth Community Radio.
If you can't forgive me then, why should I forgive you now? All of this goes way back when. Liking me was not allowed. Give up your legs. Crawl in the trenches.
to have peace.
That was Nancy Lancey with Peace in the World. And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Norman Solomon, who examines how the Bush administration is now shaping public opinion with regard to justifying a possible future U.S. military confrontation with the nation of Iran. Mona Cadena, field organizer with Amnesty International USA, who discusses recent revelations concerning the abuse and torture of detainees held by the U.S. military. And Cindy Sheehan, mother of an American soldier killed in Iraq, who explains why she has undertaken a vigil in front of President Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Interpress Service reports the Bush administration is developing a new generation of anti-personnel landmines. They are moving forward with the high-tech mines after refusing to sign the 1997 Ottawa International Treaty banning them that was adopted by 145 nations. American war planners have spent $135 million researching and developing new landmines known as the Matrix and Spider that can be activated and detonated remotely by radio signal. The National Defense Magazine reported in March that 25 of the new Matrix landmine systems were shipped to Iraq, but the Pentagon never admitted to deploying them. Officially, the U.S. has not used landmines in military operations since the 1991 Gulf War, when it deployed 100,000 landmines in Iraq and Kuwait. In 1992, the first Bush administration signed a ban on the exportation of landmines. As Steve Goose, head of Human Rights Watch's arms program, observed, "We are beginning to see the bitter fruit of the new Bush administration landmine policy. Renewed export and renewed use of these inhumane weapons may not be far behind." At 55, Nicaraguan banana worker Carlos Alberto Rodriguez is no longer able to work. His memory is gone, and he has now lost his ability to speak. His wife must feed and bathe him. Rodriguez is among the thousands of bananeros, or banana plantation workers, who are suffering from exposure to toxic pesticides used by Central American banana plantations, many owned by American food giants like Dole Foods. In the mid-1970s, Rodriguez irrigated fields to ensure even pesticide distribution of a product developed in the early 1950s by Dow Chemical and Shell called Nemagon, or DBCP, dibromochloropropane. The pesticide was banned in the U.S. in 1977 after factory workers in the U.S. who made Nemagon became sterile. Yet Dole Foods continued to use it for another year in its banana field in Honduras. According to the news magazine In These Times, injured banana workers have won a series of legal victories. In 1997, all the banana and chemical companies except Dole Foods agreed to a $41.5 million settlement paid to 26,000 banana workers in Central America, the Philippines, and Africa. In December 2002, a tribunal in Nicaragua found Dole Foods, Dow, and Shell liable for $489 million in damages to 450 workers injured by Nemagon. The three companies have refused to pay the Nicaragua tribunal judgment. In fact, they have filed a $17 billion countersuit against former plantation workers. The suit accuses the workers of fraud. In early August, the Federal Communications Commission voted to allow phone companies to block access to their digital subscriber lines, or DSL, to compete against internet providers that access these lines at discounted rates. Consumer advocates fear this decision could endanger the survival of internet service providers such as Earthlink that do not own phone or cable lines. Critics charge the recent FCC action on broadband, combined with telecom mergers like MCI and AT&T, are killing competition. The result will likely be a slower rollout of high-speed internet service. According to the American Prospect magazine, over 20% of South Koreans now use broadband internet service, twice the number of Americans. The Asian nation is also engaged in a huge public-private partnership that could soon deliver super high-speed internet connections over 50 times as fast as existing cable modems provide in the U.S. The FCC is relying on phone and cable giants who enjoy local service monopolies to provide broadband service. But to push the new technology, consumer groups are working to preserve the ability of local governments, frustrated with the slow pace of broadband expansion, to build new public sector wireless networks for underserved communities, a position aggressively opposed by companies offering cable and DSL services. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After months of unsuccessful negotiations by European diplomats, Iran's government announced on August 8th that it has resumed work on converting uranium at its Isfahan nuclear facility. Washington and European nations have warned that despite Tehran's assertion that their nuclear project is intended to develop electric power and not weapons, the matter will be brought to the UN Security Council to demand economic sanctions if Iran does not halt the program. A showdown between Iran and the West could come in September when the matter is expected to reach the Security Council. Iran insists that as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has the right to convert and enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. But Washington contends that Iran forfeited that right after admitting the nation had deceived inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency for some 17 years. Although soon after the September 11th attacks, President Bush characterized Iran as part of the axis of evil, Vice President Cheney has stated that diplomacy is the right way to handle the nuclear issue. But his warning that if diplomacy fails, all options are on the table has led observers to believe that the U.S. or Israel may be considering airstrikes against Iranian nuclear facilities. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Norman Solomon, who traveled to Iran for 10 days in June. He examines how the Bush administration is now shaping public opinion with regard to justifying a possible future U.S. military confrontation with the nation of Iran.
My overall sense is that we are in the midst of agenda building for some kind of U.S. military action against Iran. You know, if you go back a few years and you can recall the gradual step up of media spin and the think tanks that are corporate funded and aligned with the White House and the administration and their allies on Capitol Hill and journalists in general talking about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and so on and so forth, and a lot of implicit or explicit rationales for why it may be necessary to take military action. I think really, Scott, that we're in the midst of a lot of that now in terms of Iran, the continued coverage of the nuclear issue, the kind of implicit but unstated hypocritical position that it's okay for India, Pakistan, Israel to have nuclear weapons, but Iran can't even go ahead with its nuclear power development because it would be potentially helpful for nuclear weapons development down the road. The fact is that unlike the countries I just mentioned, there is membership in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty on the part of Iran. It still subjects itself to inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They haven't been totally forthcoming, but at least there are inspections. You can't say that about Israel, which has at least a couple hundred nuclear bombs. You can't say it about India or Pakistan either. And so now that Washington is trying to not allow a what they call closed loop of nuclear development, they want a very supervised situation, which according to the Iranian government is an impingement on their sovereignty. I mean, I'm against all of that. I don't think any country should have nuclear power development, let alone nuclear weapons. At the same time, the fact is that according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and nobody can really dispute this, Iran has a right to continue their nuclear energy development. And I did a lot of questioning of people across the socioeconomic spectrum in Tehran. I went to the different arenas of social life, on the street, in the bazaar, top officials, went to the university campus and so forth, and I couldn't find anybody who was against developing nuclear power for electricity. I mean, it's the success, one of the successes of the nuclear industry in the United States and the West is convince people there and elsewhere in the world, hey, you know, it's good enough for the United States, it's good enough for Iran, they have nuclear power plants, we should too.
You think the White House and the Pentagon are realistic about the dangers and the repercussions if they were to go forward with an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities?
Well, it's a kind of what C. Wright Mills called crackpot realism. Within their frame of reference, it made sense to invade Iraq for that matter. And we see some of the results. The neocons from the Project for a New American Century in the 1990s, now in control of policy to a large extent, people like Rumsfeld and so forth, they think that might does make right and that they can rearrange reality, and they are intent on doing so.
President Bush recently made a recess appointment, the first in U.S. history, of a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. John Bolton, widely disliked by many Democrats and, of course, many Republicans as well in the Senate. What do you think John Bolton's role as ambassador to the United Nations might be in the case of a ramping up and preparation for a military confrontation with Iran?
Well, I think John Bolton in many ways is an appropriate pick to represent the U.S. administration at the United Nations because his arrogance really mirrors the attitude that comes out of the Oval Office when, you know, you strip away the stylistic differences. So he's going to be a kind of a point man for the policies. And I'm not optimistic. I mean, I don't mean to be fatalistic, but I think people need to have a sense of realism. Just because the U.S. Army is tied down to some extent in Iraq, it doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of missiles and jet bombers and all the rest of it that could be utilized anywhere in the world, any region, including against Iran. And I think the role of diplomacy, both in terms of media spin and in terms of just on the world stage, is often in the hands of Washington to legitimize a movement toward war, to put forward all kinds of smoke screens and go through the pantomime and charade of seeming to seek peaceful solutions where war is very much on the agenda. And I do believe that at least an air war on Iran is quite feasible in the next year. And you can bet that what John Bolton does and the U.S. delegation at the United Nations is involved in is very much in concert with all of that war planning.
What are your concerns about the potential blowback from a U.S. airstrike on Iran's nuclear facilities?
If the U.S. does attack Iran, then I think there are all kinds of quite possible and in some cases probable results. The Shiites in southern Iraq would go ballistic. They're very close with Iran in many ways and would, I think, create more havoc for the occupiers, which is certainly, I would imagine, at least a consideration in Washington as they contemplate the possibility of military strikes. You would just unite so many Iranians. It would cause, I think, enormous havoc in the region, and not to mention the inflammation of what is called terrorism when individuals do what they can to try to cause great suffering among human beings in the West because they feel that the U.S. and Britain have used their military might to cause great suffering for human beings in places like Iraq.
That was Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Read portions of the book online at www.warmadeeasy.com. A recent series of reports concerning the mistreatment of detainees held by the U.S. military at Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba, Iraq, Afghanistan, and undisclosed prison facilities further undermines the Bush administration's contention that a few bad apples were responsible for the abuse and torture of prisoners. Declassified documents reveal that in early 2003, senior military lawyers opposed the White House view that President Bush had the authority as commander-in-chief to order harsh interrogations of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay detention camp. The dissenting opinions were registered on the grounds that the extreme interrogation techniques proposed would violate military, criminal, and international law, risking prosecutions abroad. Other arguments against the policy were made on the basis that abuse of Pentagon-held prisoners would endanger U.S. soldiers held captive and undermine America's moral standing around the world. Reports on court proceedings involving U.S. soldiers accused of abuses leading to the 2002 deaths of two detainees at America's Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan divulged that some soldiers maintained they were acting on orders from military intelligence personnel and superior officers. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Mona Cadena, field organizer with Amnesty International USA, who provides an overview of recent revelations concerning the abuse and torture of detainees held by the U.S. military.
On June 20th, 2005, we had delegates, Amnesty International delegates, visit two Yemeni detainees who were said to have just been transferred back from Guantanamo. And we released a report talking about, you know, their stories and what their experiences have been over the last 2 years and what seems like to have been a secret detention camp. And so we continue to be concerned because, you know, as you know, Guantanamo is really only one of a network of many detention centers that goes from Afghanistan to Diego Garcia to Pakistan to Iraq. You know, Amnesty estimates that there could be as many as 70,000 people held in U.S. detention outside the United States.
Say that number again, 70,000?
70,000.
I hadn't thought of it on that scale.
It's quite shocking. And, you know, what Amnesty is doing in terms of the U.S. government is, you know, we are simply asking for an independent investigation. As you know, there have been many reports come out about allegations of torture in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, you know, across the world. But there also have been some reports coming back from some of our congresspeople who have visited saying that it looks like things are okay. So we see these discrepancies here. So we're asking for an independent investigation. Somebody needs to tell us what's really happening.
The issue of torture really comes down to this. The question of whether it's the policy of the U.S. government to abuse prisoners and torture them versus a few rogue elements of the U.S. military, which have resulted in several prosecutions of abusive and sadistic guards. Which is it, do you think?
I think we ultimately don't know the answer, but the more reports we hear, the more it seems that it's not just a few rogue individuals. I mean, we know all the way up to the administration that there have been memos written trying to justify the use of torture, changing the language of what is considered torture and what isn't considered torture. So we, Amnesty International, believes that it's not just a few rogue elements, that it's, there really is a pattern in practice. For example, you know, U.S. authorities have suggested very narrow definitions of torture and described certain forms of ill treatment as stress and duress techniques, and claimed that those conditions aren't necessarily illegal, but should be justified on the grounds of military necessity or self-defense. But we know that in international law, there isn't a single legal principle that would ever justify the use of torture or any kind of ill treatment. I mean, just because you change the name from ill treatment or torture to stress and duress, you know, it doesn't make it permissible.
I was noting a news story that came up last week where it was revealed through a congressional committee that top attorneys of all branches of the U.S. military had objected to the mistreatment and torture of prisoners when a new policy was articulated to do just that by the Bush administration. So it seems that the military, for their own purposes, objected to abusing prisoners.
Yeah, well, the Army Field Manual itself, you know, contravenes these torturers, and it says interrogation techniques do not use torture, according to the Army Field Manual itself. You know, the U.S. military goes into conflict all the time. They knew how to do conflict, and when the U.S. military says to the administration, you know, these kinds of techniques are not okay, it's alarming.
In another news story, a guard at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan said he and other guards were taught techniques by their superiors on the proper way to strike detainees, which resulted in severe injury or death. So here's another piece of the puzzle, the chain of command, apparently, in this case, by this particular serviceman's testimony, says directly he was taught how to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real question is, you know, not whether or not it's a few bad apples, but how far up does it go? You know, how far up are we condoning these torture techniques?
What do we know about that question? What can you tell us about the chain of command and who is accountable for what's happening to prisoners that are being abused or tortured?
We know that up to the top, up to the U.S. administration, with memos approved by Rumsfeld and written by Gonzalez, we know that there is a lax attitude toward the use of torture at the highest levels of government at this point. We know that reports that are coming out from across the world about use of torture are not consistent with just a few bad apples, but they seem to be consistent with a pattern in practice of torture. I don't think we actually know the answer to it, and that's one of the reasons why we're calling for an independent investigation. You know, we want to know how high up it goes, and we want full responsibility up the chain of command. The more we continue to flout international law, the more we continue to thumb our noses at international human rights standards, the easier it is for everybody else to violate them as well. You know, we have a responsibility to stand up and promote, you know, human rights and human rights standards across the world, which we have been known to do. And so it's just quite frightening.
That was Mona Cadena, field organizer with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling toll-free 1-888-368-9356. Or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. In April 2004, Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, a U.S. Army specialist, was killed in Iraq. Shortly afterward, President Bush met with Sheehan and other family members of fallen soldiers. Sheehan says she was outraged when the president said her son had died for a noble cause. Later, Sheehan and another mother of a soldier killed in Iraq founded Gold Star Families for Peace to oppose the Iraq War and demand that U.S. troops be brought home. Last week, after attending the Veterans for Peace annual conference in Dallas, Sheehan says she spontaneously decided to go to Crawford, Texas, where President Bush is vacationing at his ranch. She is camping out just off the highway leading to Crawford and demanding another meeting with Bush. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sheehan by cell phone. During the brief interview, Sheehan's phone beeped several times as she received calls from supporters and journalists. Her presence at the Bush Ranch has drawn considerable attention from major corporate media as well as progressive independent outlets. Sheehan explains why she's undertaken this vigil in the Texas August heat and why she thinks her protest may mark the beginning of the end of the U.S. war in Iraq.
I was told yesterday that this was a perfect time for me to do this because there was nothing else going on. And I told the producer, the CNN producer that told me that, I said, how can you say there's nothing else going on? 30 soldiers were killed in the first 5 days of August. You know, this should always be front page news. This, you shouldn't wait until a grieving mother does this kind of an action. It should always be in the forefront of the American mind. So I'm not exactly sure, except I know that 61% of America wants the war in Iraq to end. They believe it was a mistake. They want our troops to be brought home. They only have been waiting for something to do. And this just caused an amazing groundswell of action for peace and for justice. And people have just been, like I said, waiting for something to do, waiting to be able to make their voices heard.
Were you a peace activist before your son died, or did his death trigger your activism?
Triggered the activity, not the feelings. But it did trigger the activity, and I'll regret for the rest of my life that I wasn't active before my son was killed, because I believe that one person cannot make a difference in this country. But since I've seen one person can make a difference, you know, I testified at the Downing Street hearings, and that all came about from a letter I wrote to John Conyers about the Downing Street memos. I have made a huge difference. The thinking of America since I started my peace odyssey about 3 months after my son was killed.
Does that give you any sense of peace that your son did not die in vain, because you have, through your peace journey, touched so many other people?
Well, this is what I first started. I guess we can call it my peace journey. I believe that my son died in vain because I don't believe any of them should have ever been over there, even though they are all over there for an honorable purpose. I didn't want to think that my son died in vain. I wanted to make some meaning out of his death. And if I want his death to count for peace and for love, because he was a very peaceful, loving person. And it's so ironic that he was killed in combat.
Cindy Sheehan, I understand you're not alone in your vigil. What's going on there right now?
We had about 25 people spend the night last night. They're just concerned citizens, there's many members of Code Pink, there's many members of Veterans for Peace, and of course Gold Star Families for Peace. I'm the only one from Gold Star Families for Peace right now, but more are coming. One of my founding members, whose son was killed in the same incident as my son was killed, and is going to be here later this afternoon. And there's Veterans for Peace. We were supported by Iraq Veterans Against the War and Military Families Speak Out.
You've said that you're going to stay there until President Bush meets with you or you get arrested, right?
We were told by a Texas state representative that if we're still there by Thursday, it's going to change from a freedom of speech and freedom of assembly issue to a security threat issue, and we will be arrested if we refuse to leave. I don't know who they think they're dealing with. They think they're going to intimidate me into leaving and not being arrested. They're wrong. You know, I have every right to be there, and they should be letting me use the swimming pool at the ranch after what that man took away from me. You know, if they arrest me, that is going to look horribly bad on them, but that's the only way they're going to get me to leave or have the president meet with me or August 31st. Those are my three options. And if they arrest me and let me out, I'll go back.
It seems it would be smarter for them to just wait you out rather than have you arrested and get what would probably be a lot of bad publicity.
So it'd be smart for him to meet with me is what would be smart.
Cindy Sheehan, you've said that your protest is the beginning of the end of the war. Why do you say that?
Because I think that, like I said, this has become the rallying point for the people who have always been against this war but didn't know what to do, and they're going to start putting public pressure on their officials to end this war. What we're doing is, like I said, we're bringing the war to the front page where it belongs, and the American public is ready for it to end.
Can you just describe what it's like there in Crawford, Texas, as you're vigiling near the Bush Ranch?
It's very flat. If it's not pouring down rain, it's oppressively hot. We have to sleep in, like, irrigation ditches in tents. We're going to the bathroom in 5-gallon containers. I think I do hear that a porta potty's coming out today. You know, they're horrible conditions, but you know what? Our spirits are good, because we know we're doing the right thing, and we know we have good on our side. And also, we keep thinking that no matter how bad it is for us here in Crawford, Texas, it's not nearly as bad as it is for our soldiers in Iraq and for the innocent people that have been put in jeopardy by our occupation of Iraq.
That was Cindy Sheehan, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, who was camped out near President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. For more information on Sheehan's vigil, call Code Pink Women for Peace at area code 310-827-4320 or visit her website at www.meetwithcindy.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Olinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
You're at a foreign mission, hanging on your words like a crowd at a countdown. Things could be worse. We're waiting to hear the sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy, a little light in the middle of the cage. Sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy, a little light in the middle of the page. Prophets and politicians, buyers and sellers and keepers of information. Ivory towers loom large on my television between commercials. Yeah, tell us all about your vision of the sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy, a little light in the middle of the page. Sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy, a little light in the middle of the page. Shed a little light on it all. Shed a little light on it all. Shed a little light on it all. understand. Shed a little ray of hope, and we'll hold it in our open hand. In the way of an explanation, we need a way to understand. Shed a little ray of hope for the modern woman. Prophets and politicians stand on a stage and they leave at the intermission, empty-handed. We're waiting for a glimpse at the window out on the street. Yeah, somebody yells from the back roads. The sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy, little light in the middle of the page. Sound of hope, winds of change, song of joy.
That was Patty Larkin with Pundits and Poets. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hopes for your membership and participation. Go to www.wscafm, that's wscafm.org, to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We hope to have an interview with Andrea LeBlanc, Durham resident and member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. She has recently returned from a peace delegation to Japan and has much to share with us. We leave you today with this quote by François Fenelon, theologian and writer in the 1600s. All wars are civil wars, because all men are brothers. Each one owes infinitely more to the human race than to the particular country in which he was born.